Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac Dover. Do we know what we're talking about anymore when we say socialism?
I think, you know, it's it clearly is a name that Republicans like to call people. They called FDR a communist. They called Martin Luther King a communist. They called Bill Clinton a socialist for suggesting that we have a national health care system. They called Barack Obama a socialist for essentially the same.
Yeah.
And now they're calling me one. And in that context, I take it as a compliment. I think that it's unfortunate if we get to a place where we believe that you have to be a socialist to simply want people to be treated in a way that's just. I would not like to live in that country.
Today's guest, Ben Jealous, the Democratic candidate for governor in Maryland this year, a prominent Bernie Sanders supporter, and one of the candidates Sanders has been most prominently behind this year. He's also a former head of the NAACP. Now, we've been off for a few weeks, but I'm really glad to get back rolling with him as we head into this final stretch before the midterms. Jealous, according to the public polls at least, is pretty far behind, which is saying something for Maryland, one of the most Democratic states in the country. There's only been one Republican governor between Spiro Agnew and the current one, and that guy, his name is Bob Ehrlich, was elected in the 2002 Republican wave and was turned out after one term. The current governor, Larry Hogan, is no Agnew or Ehrlich. Since being elected in 2014, he has solidified his hold on the state, is one of the most popular governors in the country, and though he's a Republican, has distanced himself almost completely from Donald Trump. I should say here that we've been trying for a year to get Governor Hogan to come on the podcast, and his staff has been unresponsive. But if they're listening, and for all of you to know, I'd love to have him on any time. There's a lot to talk about, and it's always fun to go to Annapolis. But about those polls, or any polls these days, hard to tell where they're going and how well they're doing predicting what's going on in races all around the country. Already in the Maryland primary that was back in June, Jealous went from being in polls basically in a tie with the other frontrunner and then beating him by 9 points. So now maybe he's going to win, or maybe he's about to get crushed even worse than it's looking right now. So that's part of why I wanted to talk to Jealous and why Zach and I headed over to a converted house in Silver Spring, right over the border from Washington, that he's using as his campaign office. The little upstairs room where we recorded had a treadmill propped up against the closet, which he said he'd stopped using after he hurt his hamstring out on the trail, and now it's basically a place to hang his suit jacket. But it's more about how this guy, who's been at the vanguard of activism on the left and is the first direct outgrowth of the Sanders campaign to turn around and run for office and do this well, sees what it is that we're going through. He, for example, really doesn't want to be called a socialist. He works in socially responsible venture capital these days, which means that, as you'll hear, he talked a lot about FDR, but he did it with his Platinum American Express card peeking out of the wallet that he happened to have left out on the table. What does he make of all the Democrats talking about socialism these days? And the Republicans accusing him of being a socialist? And how much pressure does he feel to win this race, not just because he wants to be governor and put his agenda into action, but because of the national significance that's going to be read into what becomes of this well-known person pushing this particular brand of politics? You'll hear what he had to say, though first you'll hear the origin story of his parents' meeting and marriage that seems to inform so much of how he thinks about himself. Remember, go on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, however you're listening, and subscribe and rate us. Tell a friend, a coworker, a family member. Spread the word. We have a lot more great guests coming up, including John Kerry in a few weeks, and many more. Follow me on Twitter, at Isaac Dover, for more on Off Message and all the other things that I'm working on. And email me your thoughts at isaac@politico.com. And now, my conversation with Ben Jealous. Tell me about the story of your parents. This is it seems like a fundamental story of your life. You have a black parent and a white parent who got together. What year was it when they were married?
Parents were married in 1966.
In Maryland?
Yeah. No. They fell in love in Maryland. They fell in love as teachers at Harlan Park Junior High in West Baltimore. Dad proposed 3 times in 1 week. And at the end of that week, they were hit with the soberness of the fact that they actually couldn't get married at my mom's church. My mom had taught Sunday school there. Her parents had taught Sunday school at St. James. And they also were hit with the fact that once they were married, they weren't allowed to return. It was illegal. The judge could have the sheriff come right into their bedroom to prove the case. So Dad essentially looked at Mom and said, hey, we already got Loving versus Virginia moving through the courts. We don't need Jealous versus Maryland too. They raised me understanding that was growing up in exile from our family and our community. And so they sent me back every summer. And they were always very clear that this was home.
They sent you back to Baltimore every summer.
Yeah, to West Baltimore. I mean, it was like growing up on a bridge between black and white, a bridge between east and west. And you know, it was a childhood where my summers were spent frying eggs on the sidewalk with my cousins in West Baltimore and running the streets. And my school years were surfing waves in California.
Where in California?
Sylmar State Beach in Pacific Grove, California was my surf spot. But I grew up in Pacific Grove. And yeah, I think some people, they expect if you're running for governor, you should be a native son of your state.
Mm-hmm.
In my case, I never had that option. I am very much a prodigal son. I'm a son who returned every chance he got. And in fact, when I became president of the NAACP, really my depth of commitment to Maryland really kind of hit me at the very moment I was being rolled out by Julian Bond, two ways. One was my mom was there. Now, my mom typically lives 3,000 miles away. And so I waited till the last minute to call her about the press conference. And she said, well, what's the address? And I said, what's the address? She said, well, I'm here for my 50th high school reunion. She said, Bennett's.
Wait, why did you wait until the last minute?
Because I assume she was in California and the press conference is in Baltimore at the headquarters. And so you just want to wake up somebody in California at 3 o'clock
in
the morning.
Oh, I see.
If you can wake them up at 5 o'clock in the morning.
But she knew you were getting the job?
No.
Why were you holding a secret from your mom?
Well, I was appointed at 3 o'clock in the morning and it was after midnight her time. So I figured I'd call her right before I went to the press conference. And that's what I did. And she was wide awake. And I said, Mom, why are you wide awake and why do you want the address? And she said, because I'm in Baltimore. I said, why are you in Baltimore? And she said, it's my 50th high school reunion. It's the first time that they invited all the black girls. My mom had desegregated Western High School in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
First group of black girls all the way through. So Mom was there because this really is home. And something like that could just happen, that she just happened to be in town for her reunion. But then Julian looked at me, the press conference, the vice chair, Rosalind Brock, was speaking. He leans over and he says, now, you know, your first order of business is to get us out of Baltimore and down to D.C. and I leaned back at him. And I said, well, look behind you. He said, yeah, who are all those people? I said, those are my cousins from West Baltimore. I didn't invite them. They just heard and showed up. And he said, so I have the wrong guy to get us to D.C.? I said, absolutely. And he said, oh, well, okay. And sure enough, the headquarters is still in Baltimore.
Were your grandparents okay with the marriage?
Grandparents were great with the marriage. They'll each tell you that they fell in love with my dad before my mom did.
Uh-huh.
My granddad fell in love day one. My parents met. They were both students at Antioch University at a cooperative education program.
Mm-hmm.
Mom taught the first year at Harlan Park Junior High. Excuse me. Mom taught the first half of the year, the fall, at Harlan Park Junior High. And dad was there to teach the spring.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't supposed to overlap. But there was a massive snowstorm. Mom's flight got canceled. Dad got in on the first bus. The bus drops him off in downtown. Most people that night chose just to kind of sleep at the station until the roads cleared and people could drive to them. But my dad's from Maine. So you tell a boy from Maine, you got to drive. You've got to walk three miles through deep snow. And he's like, okay. So my father walks way into West Baltimore and there's a shovel in the driveway. The driveway's full of snow. And again, being a boy from Maine, he picks up the shovel and he starts shoveling the driveway and shoveling the walk. And my grandfather looks out his window in January of 1966, you know, segregated West Baltimore, and sees a redheaded white boy shoveling his driveway. And he fell in love at sight. For sight, he was like, this is awesome. And my dad kept coming back and he would drink scotch with my granddad every Sunday night and grade his papers while he listened to my grandfather's jazz records. Grandfather was a bit of an introvert, and that was the easiest way to his heart. So he fell in love with my dad as his companion for whiskey and jazz. My grandma was the activist in the family. She actually turns 102 in November. Comes from a family of activists. Her grandfather was born a slave, died a state senator, co-founded Virginia State University in the family, and he was the first in our family to join the NAACP, and she grew up in it. And she fell in love with my dad when he kept getting arrested to desegregate lunch counters in Baltimore as a junior high school teacher who was upset about how his students were being treated. My grandmother's very, very light-skinned black woman with straight hair and frequently mistaken for white. And so she would just show up at the jail and they would assume that was his mom.
Mm-hmm.
And she wouldn't correct them. And so she fell in love with him when he was behind bars. And then my mom shows up in the summer and dad takes her out on a date and proposes the next day. And she says no, and proposes the next day.
So right after the first date, he proposed?
Mm-hmm. And she says no, and proposes the next day. And she says no, and proposes the third time. And she says yes.
And what happened between times two and three?
You know, I think honestly, there may have been. So the first time she said, look, I wasn't expecting to ever go out with a white guy, let alone marry one, like slow down, which is good for like 24 hours. The second time she went to her great aunt and said, you know, if he asks me again, I think I'll say yes. I've always wondered, because my great aunt was a little nosy. My great-great aunt, her great aunt was a little bit nosy. If she then called my dad, was like, hey, you need to just ask again.
My parents got engaged after 6 weeks. That seems very fast to me. That's
like slow hard motion. To beat one week.
Yeah.
and they were married 6 weeks later. And that was 52 years ago last month. Yeah. And what my parents taught me was that you take love where you can find it and you protect it fiercely. But also what they also taught me was, you don't let anybody at the end of the day tell you where your home is.
How are your father's parents about it? Also good?
His dad was dead. Mm-hmm. His father died of his third heart attack. My dad was 17. His father was 43. His mom was fine. His grandfather disowned and disinherited him, as did his one surviving
mother. His mother's parents or the father's parents?
Father's parents. My dad comes from an old New England family. His first ancestor to come to America ultimately died in Maryland in like 1656, I believe. And his uncle drove to where they were both at a summer program, part of Antioch University, had a summer program in Vermont, drove over from Maine, sat down with him and said, look, I believe you're in love with this woman. But I know a man can fall in love with many women and you need to go fall in love with somebody else or you're going to lose your family. My dad says that my mom saved him. He said they just, you know, it was finally the family didn't reach out again until that uncle would call right after I won the Rhodes Scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, I said to my dad, well, aren't you going to call him back? And he said, Ben, he wasn't much fun when he was sane. Now that he's senile, why would I want to talk to him? So I, on the other hand, have always been a bridge builder. And so Jealous is a very unique name. There's maybe 60 of us in the country. And whenever I bump into one, I try to befriend them, and I've gotten, you know, reconnected with different cousins, and some of us have a good relationship. But the grandson of the uncle who was involved with the grandfather mm-hmm. disowning my dad, I bumped into him. It didn't go so well. His first name, like mine, starts with a B, and he said, it's really annoying. I just got to tell you, it's very annoying. I now have the same dry cleaner you used to have, and occasionally my pants get delivered to your old address and it's very annoying. And I said to him, well, that's fair. And he said, how do you figure? I said, well, my dad lost his shirt and now you're losing your pants.
You had pleasure saying that.
But it was,
Do you think you like telling that story more? Was it more fun to say that in the moment or to keep telling that story since?
This is the first time I've ever told it publicly. But it's Henry Louis Gates Jr. Once tallied up what my father lost. It was a lot of money. He's the direct descendant of the founder of Sargent Hardware, which is a massive American company that was sold for $16 billion in the 90s. He lost a lot of money marrying my mom, and he said it was the best decision that he ever made.
Let's stay on family for a minute, but in a different kind of way. Dave Chappelle is like basically a brother of yours, essentially.
Yeah.
When did you guys first meet?
We were introduced as babies by our dads. Our fathers were best friends. Dave's dad worked for Social Security here while he studied to be an opera singer.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad had just gotten back from teaching in Turkey, and they just became card-playing buddies. But we mostly knew each other growing up as photos. Men are not the best correspondents. Like the women in my family, they'll stay in touch. They'll exchange baby photos every year. Dads exchange photos like every like life stage. So so Dave, I was shocked when we reconnected. We were both 18. We're only 6 months apart in age. And I had moved to New York. I'd skipped a grade and moved to New York the year before him. I came up to go to college. He came up to go to be a comedian.
Yeah, because he was performing already when he was like 15, right?
Right. And I was like, where's your where's all your hair? He's like, what? I was like, well, that photo of you always hasn't. Ben's like, Ben, that photo was taken when I was 12. I was like, yeah, I guess you might have cut your hair since you were 12. And he's like, and where's that horrible sweater? And I was like, what? He's like, oh, right. The last photo you had, I was 12 too. So, the way we connected, I was on a mission. His father had told me I needed to just explain to Dave how much I loved college. Dave is the first man in his family since slavery not to go to college. And it was a big deal to his dad. And long story short, on that first day of reconnecting, I watched Dave make $750 in 15 minutes telling jokes in a park. And I just told him, don't worry about your dad. I'll go talk to him. If college has taught me anything, it's you cannot make $750 in 15 minutes unless you do something illegal, immoral, or what you just did.
Yeah.
So that's pretty awesome.
I mean, you're the one with the Rhodes Scholarship, but he was worth more money than you are.
Worst decision Dave Chappelle could have ever made would be to go to college. He's one of those rare people.
But you guys are still tight.
Always. We've been through a lot together, and it's a real blessing when you can inherit from your father's a friendship.
That is a different kind of thing. It's sort of an arranged marriage of friends, right?
It is. Well, you stay in this life, there's the family you inherit and the family you choose. And our fathers chose to live as family, to be brothers. And when we were 18, we made the same choice. And it's been great. We're both blessed in many ways to be doing what we were doing when we were 14 years old. When I was 14, I was an organizer mm-hmm. on Jesse Jackson's first campaign. And when he was 14, he was in the clubs in D.C., and we talk about that often. I mean, we've both grown up, but we've been blessed to basically grow up doing one thing. In my case, that's pulling people together to get big things done.
Yeah. I think when I was 14, I was collecting comic books. As I was thinking about it, all of this, the background you come into this race with and sort of where you are politically right now, you have had a situation where you are known for the work that you did before you got into politics more directly mm-hmm. from the NAACP, the organizing. Mm-hmm. Then you were a very prominent supporter of Bernie Sanders yeah. in 2016. And then, of course, now running yourself with Bernie Sanders' support, with the support of a lot of other people, too. Mm-hmm. And at the forefront of people trying to understand what is going on with is this a new leftward lurch of the party and attaching a lot of things onto you? And about a month ago, you were out on the trail and a reporter said to you, you're already laughing, you know what I'm gonna say, yeah. Asked you if you are socialist.
Yeah.
And you said, are you fucking serious?
Yeah.
Which you apologized for the word choice afterwards. But the sentiment there, I mean, socialism, what's wrong with socialism? It seems like Democrats are all caught up in it at the moment.
Yeah, the context before that, I spent a minute and a half explaining what I do for a living, mm-hmm. which is grow small businesses into big businesses. I'm a practicing capitalist, if you will. and so that was the buildup, if you will, to the punchline. I think we just got to get back to being the party of FDR.
Isn't there a lot of socialism in FDR?
Well, FDR is a hero of a lot of people. I think some people who see themselves as socialists would say, sure. Mm-hmm. And some people who see themselves as capitalists would say, no. And in either case, it's pretty irrelevant. What was important was what he got done for the people of the country. That in tough times, in FDR in my grandma's house, his photo hung right next to Jesus and before the bishop. and you didn't have to question why he was there. He was there because when times are toughest in our country and toughest in the world, he had the courage to level with the people about what it would take to overcome the challenges we confronted. And then he pulled everybody together to go get it done. And as Democrats, we got to get back to being the party of transformative women like Barbara Jordan and Barbara Mikulski. And those transformative men we remember by their three-letter if you will, names, FDR, LBJ, JFK, RFK, MLK. We do that, and we all start moving forward again. In this race, maybe it's the professor in me, maybe it's the business leader in me, it certainly is the civil rights leader in me. I feel like I have no choice but to just be honest with people and say, high cost of college is hurting all our families. High cost of healthcare is hurting all our families. Those of us like me with kids in the public schools, we're nervous our schools keep falling in the rankings under this governor. And all of us are hurting because our economy is stuck. We're dead last in the region in job growth, dead last in income growth. If we had Virginia's job growth, we'd be 50,000 more jobs in Maryland today. If we had their income growth, we'd all be making on average $8,000 a year more. It's not happening here. And then to tell them what it will take. So that means one week I'm talking about healthcare for all, Medicare for all. I mean, next week I'm talking about it's time to finally fully fund our schools and make them the fattest pipeline of talent into every industry in the state. So every kid graduates ready for a career, not just for college. And the next week I'm talking about, yeah, we actually should close the loophole that allows hedge fund managers to pay a lower tax rate than their secretaries and take that money and lower the sales tax so we're more competitive. And some people look at that and say, oh my gosh, you're contradicting yourself. I look at it and say, I'm just trying to make us more competitive.
Yeah, lower the sales tax is not something that would come up in a lot of socialist thinking, yeah, right?
Again, but if your mindset is how do we grow again, they all make sense. What drove me to support Medicare for All is I tried to move a factory from Northern Canada to South Baltimore.
In your job now? You mean,
yeah. Yeah. Spent 6 months of my life doing it. And the deal fell apart because our healthcare costs kept surging. And like a lot of small business people in Maryland, and I even have like a guy who's a finance manager at a car dealership who voted for Trump, who supports me because I support Medicare for All, I've been forced by surging healthcare costs up 134% in Maryland in the last 3 years to figure out what could work.
Yeah.
And I went straight to Medicare for All because what kept that made that deal fall apart was that the entrepreneur could afford the current cost structure, but if healthcare costs were up significantly the next year, he couldn't make any money. His company ended up leaving Northern Canada. They served the Orthodox Jewish market, much bigger market in the U.S., needed to be closer. He moved it to Toronto because he literally couldn't afford to cross the border because of healthcare cost instability. Medicare, we just have to admit, they leverage everybody in the system to get a better deal in pharmaceuticals, and they have a more stable price as a result. And so that's why. So for me, it really is about business. Education, similarly, I mean, to be really clear, education and healthcare, there's great moral reasons. In politics, you often, in order to get the moral to become law, you got to find the practical to get everybody else on board and to create, you know, the practical impetus with education is we're paying a steep price for kids who have no idea how to succeed in our society. And, you know, the older I get, the more Steve Forbes starts to make sense in education. I remember 88 campaigns, my first campaign where I'm paying attention. I'm 14 years old and working for Jackson. Steve Forbes in every debate would say, we need an education system more like, he's running as a Republican that year, you know, more like Germany, more like Northern Europe. We have apprenticeship programs and, you know, young people, if they decide they want to go a different route and head off towards university, they can do that. But they can also just know every year they're in school, they're preparing to support a family. And that's my goal. And so, you know, I've been very clear that we'll make our community colleges tuition free. Why? So we can push more vocational education to high school, create more apprenticeships, and make sure every kid comes out ready for a career. And so in that respect, the sales tax actually becomes the logical next step. If you're trying to make your economy more competitive by creating a better deal in healthcare and an educational system that's more efficiently connected to the economy, of course you would be concerned about the fact that your sales tax is higher than neighboring states and thus may make it less likely that retailers would locate in your jurisdiction and would prefer to go right across the border to somewhere else.
What do you think 14-year-old you would have to say about hearing you say now that Steve Forbes was right?
On education and vocational education. Yeah, 14-year-old me was fine. You know, I have always been somebody who's been driven by a strong moral grounding, even in business. What Mitch Kapoor and I do at Cape Work Capital is we are seeking to prove that you don't have to park your values at the door to make money. And 14-year-old me would recognize the moral imperative in what Steve Forbes was talking about. With that said, at the time, I just looked at him as a greedy capitalist who wanted us all to be his minions. Today, I realize that he understood that for people to really be free, they've got to be able to have a career, and that our education system is the one chance we get to, as W.B. Du Bois would say, you know, grow strong children, as opposed to have to on the back end fix broken adults.
Do you think socialism, it's the hot word. A lot of Democrats have been talking about how they're socialists. President Trump has been complaining about socialists. It seems like it's taken on the place in the political conversation like liberal was years ago. The president had that line a couple weeks ago where he said, the Democrats want to steal from Medicare to pay for socialism. Do we know what we're talking about anymore when we say socialism?
Well, I think, you know, it's... It clearly is a name that Republicans like to call people. They called FDR a communist. They called Martin Luther King a communist. They called Bill Clinton a socialist for suggesting that we have a national healthcare system. They called Barack Obama a socialist for essentially the same.
Yeah.
And now they're calling me one. And in that context, I take it as a compliment.
But you have a lot of Democrats who are now much more eager to own it.
Yeah.
You know,
that's always been there. I come from a tradition of civil rights leaders, black business people. You know, we come from a different place in many instances, which is frankly our faith growing up in the church. You know, it's Matthew 7:12. It's, treat others as you would like to be treated. It's the golden rule. Mm-hmm. It's the essence of not just our faith, but every faith, and even ethical codes followed by those of no faith at all. And so I think that it's unfortunate if we get to a place where we believe that you have to be a socialist to simply want people to be treated in a way that's just. I would not like to live in that country.
I was at the speech that Obama gave a couple days ago in Illinois, coming back onto the scene. And there was a protester there that had a sign that said sort of a caricature of him. And it said cultural Marxist. And he was just standing there outside the auditorium where Obama was. It was the kind of sign that I saw a lot when Obama's president.
And whenever I see the signs that would flash in my eyes, like, WTH is that?
Well, I'll tell you more than that. A college student was walking by, a young woman, and she looked at the sign and she said, Marx is awesome, man. You should read his stuff, which to me just sort of captured what is going on here, which is that I don't know that 10 years ago, at the beginning of Obama's presidency, you would have had such a connection to Marx and socialism being talked about as a good thing by Democrats and certainly by younger Democrats. But it seems like we're there.
Well, last time I checked, FDR is the most popular political figure in the country, even though he's no longer with us. And what he represents is us coming together to act with courage to build an economy in which all of us can really prosper. He really gave birth to the rise of the middle class in this country. That's where we need to get to. I think there's a whole range of people on the word socialism who understand it and believe in it, see it as sort of embrace it as a rallying cry against a system that they see as corporate controlled and corrupt, and folks who just simply want a better deal. And hey, it sounds like maybe that group of folks over there is more empathetic. What I know is that somebody who on one side descends from 9 Revolutionary War soldiers and on the other side from 2 black Reconstruction statesmen, is there has always been a strong current in our country of Americans who want this to be a city on a hill, a beacon for human rights, a place where people are treated better because we all have a stake and we exist beyond the patterns of feudalism that we emerged out of and rejected. And my politics and the capitalism I practice is very much focused on that. I mean, don't get me wrong, I invest in companies we believe will be highly profitable, but only if we believe they'll build stronger communities, give working people a better deal. Prime example of that, it's a company called Pigeonly, founded by a graduate of Morgan State, co-founded by a graduate of Morgan State.
Black college.
Mm-hmm, in Baltimore, who had done time for marijuana distribution and came home deeply unsettled by how expensive it was for inmates' families to stay in touch with them. Because he knew the inmates are better connected to their families, are more likely to stay out of prison when they get out. He did something that we could never do as activists. I tried for more than a decade to get the FCC to lower rates for calling home from prison. Never would do it. He cut the cost of having your loved one call home from prison by 80% using voice over IP technology and created a company that for several years was growing 20% a month. There is a place in our country for business people, for activists, for civic leaders who simply want us to all be able to do better together, right? When we all do better, to fight for working people. That place should be the Democratic Party. And what my campaign has been about is showing that we can pull together people across a broad range of, if you will, ideologies around a core agenda that says, if we have the courage to pass the policies that empower us to do better, we will all do better.
I want to ask you about Obama, not in the context of whether he's helpful to be out on the campaign, actually, because that's a whole different debate. As far as within the Democratic Party, do you see the future of the Democratic Party as a continuation of Obama or as something that needs to branch off away from him?
What was best about Obama is he reminded us that we were the party of Barbara Jordan, Barbara Mikulski, and MLK, and RFK, and FDR. And we need to deepen that groove. If we are not for working people, and small business people are part of working people, if we aren't for working people, who is? And, you know, you go around our state, the opioid epidemic has surged. Murders are up across the entire state, even when you remove Baltimore from the equation, 40%, without counting Baltimore. You listen to young people, the 8-year-old Black boy in the housing projects my mom grew up in told me he'd seen too many dead men. 13-year-old white girl growing up in a rural community like the one that my father spent half his childhood in. So we're in a rural small town in America. She told me she'd buried 3 classmates who had become addicted to pills in the last 12 months. Hope is disappearing from our children's lives much faster than many of us would like to admit. The Democratic Party knows how to make hope real. That's what all those folks we've been talking about have done. That's the best of Obama's legacy as a candidate and a president. And I'm very much running to extend that, to pick up where Obama finished and to really help revive us as the, you know, revive the spirit of FDR in our party.
What do you make of the idea of there being a backlash to him, that he's sensitive to that, other people have, and that what you see with a lot of the Republican victories that happened in the year since he won in 2008, in 2014, Larry Hogan was elected as a Republican running against another Democrat who was a Black man also, Anthony Brown, in a year that was very bad for Democrats in 2014, sort of set up what happened in 2016. Does it make sense to you that this is a backlash against Obama as a lot of people see it?
I have 2 thoughts on that. One's a conversation I had with General Colin Powell a long time ago, and he's been an advisor throughout my career. Every few years, we'll sit down. He said to me a long time ago, he said, "Ben, it's easy to figure out what you can disagree with people on. What's tougher and more important in a democracy is to figure out the one thing you can agree on and go get that done." And so when I look at Obama's legacy, what I focus on are the places where we made strides in the right direction. I say we because I was president of the NAACP throughout the first 5 years, and it was probably not a major piece of social legislation that he passed in that period that we weren't part of helping pass. And then, you know, how do we extend that? So like ACA is a great advance forward. Obamacare, where we actually need to get, is Medicare for All.
Which he actually dropped in that speech. He said it.
And he recognizes that. He's an organizer. He's a student of politics. He understands that if you occupy the Oval Office for 8 years, the best thing you can do is move things in the right direction towards a destination you're unlikely to get to and hope that the next person picks it up. Right now, we're in a place where we have to practice forward-thinking federalism, where the far-right wing has taken over every branch of our federal government, and the best thing we can do is to make our states models, and that's what I'm running to do. The other piece of that, though, is Obama inspired us to dream big again, and that's where we need to be. I mean, think about what an achievement the ACA was relative, how Clinton got stuck, and then the people were stuck for decades on making an advance in healthcare. I mean, I've met person after person who have said, I wouldn't have my small business if it weren't for Obamacare. I would have stayed in a dead-end job, or I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Obamacare. And yet we know there's 350,000 people in our state who will go to bed tonight who have no health care. And there's many more who are afraid to use their health care because it's become the number one cause of bankruptcy in the state. I mean, it's been that didn't change. And so I'm eager to be part of getting my state back to moving forward quickly again. And my own experience, I mean, the moment I fell in love with Maryland politics was 2012, I was working on Obama's re-election, if you will, leading the NAACP and turning out unlikely voters, would be called the unsung hero of Obama's re-election on CNN for turning out 1.2 million unlikely voters.
I'm just going to drop that as a passing thing. That's the modesty that most people know politicians for.
But what I was really focused on that year, what had my attention, we were running three campaigns in Maryland. I was leading the campaign to abolish the death penalty. I was co-chairing the campaign to pass the DREAM Act, and Chad Griffin, the head of HRC, on his first day on the job, we got together and figured out a strategy to move votes to make sure that marriage equality would pass on the ballot.
Right, fusing African-American civil rights work with LGBT
and activism. With Latinos. And a whole bunch of progressive whites.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, in Maryland, DACA, the DREAM Act, our local version of the DREAM Act really passed with the sort of enthusiastic kind of groundswell amongst Black women. I mean, it was a great fusion moment. And that's when I realized how we can literally declare the motto of the Three Musketeers, all for one and one for all, and get big things done. And that's what fuels me in this campaign more than anything else is, this love affair with the politics of our state. And I grew up the stories of Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman and my mom suing her high school and my dad in protest and Juanita Mitchell, whose kids my grandma watched for every branch meeting of the NAACP, and Clarence Mitchell and Perrin Mitchell and Barbara Mikulski, who my grandma trained. And these were all larger than life figures who were the stories of, bedtime at grandma's house. But then in that moment, to see all these communities come together. And that year, we didn't just become the first state south of the Mason-Dixon to do any of them, which we were. We were also the first state to do all of them. And so, I'm running and people are saying, Ben, the things you want to do are hard and you want to make advancements in education and healthcare policy and the economy all at once. And is that too much? And I just look at them and say, that's been my whole life. I specialize in getting hard things done. That's why I was named Marylander of the Year by the Baltimore Sun.
Another one you're just going to drop.
For those three victories. But I think it's important because, I've been running against a guy who wants to pretend like I'm not from here. I'm not of here. I don't know how to get anything done. And the reality is quite the opposite. And he also wants people to believe as part of that, that they shouldn't hope for anything big, that they should be grateful for the status quo. And yet his entire leadership has proven that there's a cost to everything, including doing nothing. And the cost to doing nothing has been that we've fallen behind in the education rankings. Every year we drop the national education rankings under his leadership. Our healthcare costs are surging and our economy is stuck. And so I think if Obama reminds us of anything is that there's a power to hope when you marry it with practical policies, and that's that we actually move forward.
But do you feel right before you won your primary, it had been an ongoing bad streak for people that Bernie Sanders was supporting. They kept losing primaries. And there was a thought, okay, well, you were not seen as like for sure to win. And a lot of people thought
I lost every poll. In fact, there was one poll that I broke through on the Washington Post. And then they put in an extra graphic to explain that their own poll had no meaning.
But right before the primary, there was a spate of stuff that was like, oh, well, like, I guess that's it. And jealous will be the sort of nail in the coffin on the Bernie Sanders thing. And then you won. Yeah. And then a couple of other people won.
Stacey won.
Right.
Gillum won. Ocasio won. Yeah.
And, well, Sanders did not endorse Ocasio-Cortez until afterwards, notably. Yeah. But now it does because maybe it was just the way the calendar was or how politics was moving. Do you feel, again, the polls, you can question them, sure, and there are reasons too, where we're all wondering what the likely voter model is at this point. But in the public polling, you're behind. Mm-hmm. Do you feel a burden to say that if you don't, as someone who's so much identified with this, if you lose, and if you lose badly in a state that is, I mean, we've had one Republican governor in Maryland since Spiro Agnew, right?
Two. We've had Ehrlich and Hogan.
Right. Yeah. But other than Hogan, I'm sorry. Yeah. That it says something about what kind of appetite there actually is for your kind of politics?
The only burden I feel is to win. And we feel good. There's a pollster out there, released a poll that said, you know, Jealous is back 16 points. Same pollster 2 weeks before I won by 10 points, undercounted my support by 17 points. So I'm looking at his batting average and I'm like, well, what you're telling me is I'm ahead by one. You know,
it's a hard thing for a reporter these days. And I've been saying this to a lot of people because when politicians tend to say, oh, you know, I'm really feeling it out there. And the reporters say, like, well, it's because you're only going to your own rallies, right?
But over and over, pollsters are looking worse than weathermen these days,
And that's why I think it's hard for reporters, because we need to somehow incorporate that, but also not fall for every politician who will say, like, really, it's going great.
Salesman, yeah. The burden I feel to win comes from the fact that the same polls will tell you people don't feel like they're better off. They're totally stressed out about schools. They're totally stressed out about the cost of healthcare, the cost of college, the opioid epidemic that's touching all of our communities in the most horrible way. And as you travel the state, what you feel, even as I feel support, I know it's deeper in the general than the pollsters measure, just like it was deeper in the primary. What you feel more than anything is the weight of the fact that 80% of people's problems, give or take, all across the state are the same, right? High cost of college, schools falling in rankings, price of healthcare surging, friends dying from rationing medication, friends dying from the opioid crisis. And you know that the other side is practicing the politics of division. The RGA has unleashed horrible, hateful ads on Maryland, very much reflective of the politics of Trump, playing from an old playbook of divide and conquer. And you know that if you just raise the resources and make sure that your message breaks through, the people are ready to come together because they recognize their own struggles in the reflection that is their neighbor, even when their neighbors are of a different color or different economic strata or a different faith. We just listen to each other. And yeah, I've seen it happen on the trail. I mean, this guy, Billy, finance manager, voted for Trump, working the car dealership. I kind of referenced him earlier. And one day I was coming back to check in with him. And he agreed to meet me at a local lawyer's office, a mutual friend, just a place that we can meet. And I was 45 minutes late. And I walk in the door and I'm like, Billy, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. He's like, Ben, he's like, don't worry about it. He's like, I got to talk to these young people. They're awesome. The young people he's talking about are a bunch of dreamers. Mm-hmm. This guy voted for Trump. So I'm like, how was the conversation? And he says, it was great. He said, you can sign me up for supporting the Dream Act too. And I said, wow, Billy, like these are like political, like cartwheels. Like you vote for Trump, you're back in the NAACP chief is running for governor. You know, you vote for Trump, you're supporting the Dream Act. He said, Ben, I told you. It's real simple. My bottom line are my people and my business. He said, neither one of them get healthier until we fix the healthcare crisis. That's why I'm supporting you. And he said, and I only make money if I sell more cars.
But is he still supporting Trump?
He voted for him and relished it. And I think, and I'm not sure actually, we don't even talk about that. And he said, and I suspect probably on some things and not on others. I know he's ticked at him over healthcare, which is why he's supporting me, but I don't know how much further that goes. And he said, and as for these young people, he said, they're great. He said, you know, they're either in school or they got jobs. He said, and you know what? They all want to buy cars. And they can't get a loan until they get status. He said, so by all means, let's get them immigration status so they can get a loan to buy a car from me.
It's kind of move some merchandise,
and
right?
And that's the conversation we need to be having in our communities, because there's actually great self-interest in fixing each other's problems. You know, Billy fixes their problem that they don't have status, and he fixes his own problem, which is that he's not selling enough cars.
Hey, the weird thing about it is that your politics don't agree with Donald Trump's at all, but that, like, there is something that tracks from you and Larry Hogan with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, where there were voters who Hillary Clinton's argument was like, well, let's just keep doing this and make some incremental changes. And Donald Trump's argument basically boiled down to everything you've been doing hasn't worked. So let's just try something completely different. Now, it's not what you wanted, right? But Hogan is making an argument that says, look, I've been running the state really well. Things have been moving. You may disagree with some of the ways that that's what he's saying. It's a management thing. And your argument is, let's try some new stuff that people might say is crazy, and like, but we have to change it, right?
Yeah, I was arguing that Donald Trump was a threat long before George Stephanopoulos was cracking up at Keith Ellison suggesting that he might win the Republican nomination. You know, out there on the stump with Bernie Sanders all across the country. And I remember I was in the Ozarks, and I was blown away with the reception that we got. And that it wasn't like college kids who were like, maybe like we're at Southwest Missouri State University from St. Louis, I assume some of them were it was mostly people who were just like from the Ozarks. And there was a whole contingent of guys in deer hunting camouflage. And I kept my eye on them, you know, part because like I'm a black guy, you know, rooted in Baltimore. And I feel a little uncomfortable being in the Ozarks, never been there before. And if there was like, in my mind, people I was afraid of in the Ozarks, it would look like these guys, right? They're there in a group and, you know, is there a metal detector, you know? So I go out to give a speech, and I'm supposed to introduce Bernie Sanders. And I say to Bernie's campaign manager, like, are you really sure you want me? Like this crowd, the former head of the NAACP, they're going to respond well to me. Isn't there somebody else? And he said, I'm sure it'll be great. You go do it. And I gave my speech about the danger of Donald Trump, and they were on fire. And ostensibly, it's because their neighbors were even more on fire for Donald Trump. And they understood just how dangerous and volatile that was for the country. So I could contextualize that. And then Bernie went out there and he gave a speech, the first same speech, right?
It's like, he always gives the same.
It's like Freebird, you know what I'm saying? People are yelling out lines.
The thing, what I remember from covering the Sanders campaign is that in every speech, he would get to the point where he says, legalize pot, which I know is an issue of yours too. Yeah. But, and some reporter would write it down like, oh my God, Bernie Sanders. And we would all say,
it was the same speech.
He just said it 10 times. Like, yeah, right. But hilarious. The Bernie Sanders speeches, and they continue to be like almost minute by minute.
Yeah,
exactly
the same thing. And so you know, and about halfway through comes a place where he calls on the police to stop killing unarmed civilians and black women, black men. And those guys in the deer hunting jump up on their seats, holler, and throw their fists in the air. And I'm like, what just happened? And then it occurs to me, you know, we're Democrats. We practice this thing called identity politics. We actually do it for a reason, which is we don't want to show up to the NAACP the way Mitt Romney did, where he pretended like racism didn't exist and then nobody listened to him. So we make a point of talking about your issues, and then we hope you listen to the second half of the speech where we talk about everybody's issues and we ask you to be an ally. And Bernie had spent the first half hour talking about making it possible essentially for these men to feel like men again, you know, building things here again, growing small businesses, fixing healthcare, raising the minimum wage. And they could see, you know, making college affordable, ending mass incarceration, which, you know, We don't just have the most incarcerated black and brown people on the planet. We also have the most incarcerated white people on the planet. And they all come from the same economic strata. And these guys are of that strata, appeared to be. And so having done that, he then called for them to be an ally to somebody else. And like every other group in our society that the Democratic Party actually talks to, as opposed to working class white men, which we have too often not spoken to, they were ready to be an ally to somebody else. And so, yeah, you know, I respond to the pain that courses all through our state and our country. There are folks who, you know, have responded to that more forcefully. Bernie and Trump both did last year. But what's different between me and any Republican, let alone who I'm running against, is I'm a professor of public policy and a businessman and a retired civil rights leader who only knows how to put real solutions on the table. Real solutions that will change real lives in real time. Donald Trump's out there selling hate and snake oil. I'm here.
We've got to do something different sense. But well, like, I'm not surprised that you do not want to connect yourself to Donald Trump. No. But there is sensibly something there that connects. And I think it connects to people all over the country, in every state, in every city, feeling like things are not working as well as they should be.
What you see with Gillum and Stacey, and I've known Andrew since he was 20, and I've known Stacey since she and I were 20. We're about 10 years older than Andrew. It's like the old Hair Club for Men commercial where the guy said, you know, I'm not just the president, I'm also a member, and he pulled off like his toupee.
Yeah.
We're all of our families are of the classes of people who are directly impacted by the problems we're trying to solve. We've had student debt. We have family members who are in poverty. We have family members, you know, in my case, I've had two family members shot in Maryland in the last 10 years. And we're organizers. And so, yeah, I will, you know, never sort of accept anybody kind of comparing me to Donald Trump, principally because I know where he was on the Central Park Five, and I know where I was.
Well, sure. No, that's what, not in any of the specifics, but in the general.
But what I would say is that the people who are upsetting the pollster's prognoses right now are people who are tapping into the pain of the people of this country. And I'm proud to be an old civil rights leader and the nation's youngest retired civil rights leader and a business person who feels obligated just to level with people about what it's going to take to solve their problems.
Last question here. I know you're focused on your race, 2018. Yeah. There are a lot of people who are getting ready to decide about running for president, Democratic side.
Several of my close friends.
Yes.
Literally. You know, Eric Garcetti and I ran for student council together. I officiated his wedding. Like, I got simple friends in this, but go on.
And Cory Booker, I know. Yeah. They also know.
Since we were Rhodes Scholars and Kamala Harris for 15 years since she was a young district attorney in San Francisco.
So your friends and the ones you don't know as well, when they look at what this year has been so far, as they get to making the decision, most of them are not going to make a decision until after they see what happens in the midterms. What do they need to sense about what it is to win a Democratic primary?
Politics today is truly about people and votes, not polls and money. They have to be willing to get out there like Obama did, like Howard Dean did, and just let people fall in love with them by really showing people love, showing people that they're impatient to see the voters' lives progress more quickly. We're suffering. The people of America are suffering under the heavy weight of a bunch of half measures, not quite ever solving the problem. And they're eager for authenticity. People feel very comfortable saying that. I've heard it again and again. But what that really means with voters is they're eager for you to tell them the truth about how we actually move forward. And that's why I'm so urgent about us getting back to being the party of FDR, the party that has the courage to lead, the courage to level with people, the courage to just tell them the truth of what it's actually going to take so that they live in a country that's measured by increasing prosperity for all of us, not just the wealthiest 1 or 1/10 of 1%, but also, frankly, not measured by debt. And right now, so much of life in America is, frankly, better measured in debt than in prosperity.
Well, that's sort of a down note to end on, but I think that's where we'll leave it. Ben Jealous, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you. It's been fun.
So, do you buy the way that he's trying to parse his politics? Were you surprised to hear a guy who's for universal healthcare also backing lowering the state sales tax? Did that connection between Trump and Clinton and Hogan and him make any sense? You think he has any shot to win? You think he should? Email me at isaac@politico.com and let me know. Thanks to Zach Stanton for producing, as always. And please, spread the word. Tell everyone you know that they should be downloading and listening to all the great episodes we're going to come at you with all through the fall. And while you're at it, follow me on Twitter at Isaac Dover. I promise I'll try to give you some interesting thoughts and articles that you should be reading, but also maybe even make you laugh every once in a while on there. And catch you next time on Off Message.